Welcome to SCOTUSCast, Same-Sex Marriage Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On April 28, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Obergefell v. Hodges. This highly anticipated case concerned two questions. The first is whether states are required by the 14th Amendment to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples. The second question is whether states are required by the 14th Amendment to recognize the marriages of same-sex couples who were lawfully married in a different state. To discuss the case, we have John Eastman, who is the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service at the Chapman University Fowler School of Law. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Eastman.
I'd like to add, I wear a couple of other hats, and they both seem particularly relevant to our topic of our call today. I'm the chairman of the board of a National Organization for Marriage, and I'm also the founding director of the Claremont Institute's Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, which is counsel of record in two of the 155 briefs that were filed in this case. So the background quickly is, as we know, the Supreme Court 2 years ago struck down a portion of the Defense of Marriage Act. Since that decision in 2013, a number of lower federal courts have used that decision to strike down state marriage laws. I think they've misused that decision, and we'll talk about that in the terms of the oral argument today. And the Fourth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit, the Tenth Circuit and the Ninth Circuit cases were all up by the Supreme Court last October, and the Supreme Court denied review in all of them, sending the signal to many people that the court believed those decisions were correct. The Sixth Circuit, with a very thorough opinion by Jeff Sutton, then comes out and upholds the marriage laws in Michigan, Ohio, Kentucky, and Tennessee, the four states that are covered by the Sixth Circuit's jurisdiction. And the Supreme Court then had a circuit split on its hand, and it took those cases. And it asked the council to address two questions. One, does the 14th Amendment require states to license same-sex marriage relationships as marriages? And then two, assuming the Constitution doesn't require that, are those states nevertheless required to recognize marriages among same-sex couples that are performed in other states where they have become legal? And the court divided the argument this morning, an hour and a half on the first question, and then an hour on the second question. The reason the first one got a little bit extra time is the United States weighed in as an amicus in support of the challengers to the Ohio, Michigan, Kentucky, and Tennessee laws in that one. And right out of the box, the lawyer for the petitioners, Mary Bonato, was confronted with Justice Ginsburg saying, Wenzer tells us that we have to give deference to the states. doesn't it say that? And Ms. Bonato correctly, I think, pointed out that, yes, the states do have primacy in deciding marriage policy and domestic relations law. But as Justice Kennedy pointed out in Windsor repeatedly, they nevertheless have to comply with the Constitution. So we're back to the question, does the 14th Amendment's requirements of due process and equal protection prohibit the states from defining marriage as between a man and a woman? Now, Chief Justice Roberts, and there's been some speculation that he might be a vote up for grabs here, his first question right out of the box, I think, put that speculation to rest immediately. He came after Ms. Bonato and said, what you're not seeking to have new people enter the institution. You're not seeking to join the institution as it exists. You're seeking to redefine it, to change what it is. And that then set up a very powerful, and I think if you're a tea leaf reader, insight into Justice Kennedy, who many people think will really be the dispositive vote here. And he says, one of the problems with your whole argument, and I like to focus on specific words, is this word millennia. And he says, you know, there was a time between Brown, when the court decided Brown versus Board of Education and said no to segregation, and then when it decided Loving versus Virginia. And he said there was a similar, about the same amount of time, a dozen years or so, between the time the court decided Bowers versus Hardwick and when it reversed course and decided Lawrence versus Texas. But then he said, here we're talking about millennia. He said, I don't know how to take the time between our decision in Windsor and millennia. I can't calculate out enough decimal points to figure out how much, and you're asking us to overturn millennia. That was rather dramatic. And she kind of ducked and wouldn't answer the question. And so several people came back at the question at her several times in different ways. And finally, Justice Breyer very pointedly said, you've been ducking those questions. You've been giving us, nonsense answers, non-answers to those questions. I want an answer to the precise question that you were asked in the briefs and didn't address, that you were asked several times here this morning already. What about millennia? You're asking us to overturn millennia. You're asking nine of us to change something that's been around for a millennia and to change it and mandate it in all 50 states. And he was not impressed with her answer there any more than he had been impressed with her answer the previous couple of times had been asked. Now, Justice Kennedy seemed very troubled by what was being asked here. And as I said, I think he's really the swing vote. Justice Alito came in and says, kept asking questions about what the limiting principle was. If we say the Constitution mandates states to issue licenses to same-sex couples because they express love and commitment to each other, then what about two men and two women who express love and commitment toward each other? What about other sorts of relationships, adult siblings, stepfather and stepdaughter, all these other kind of things? And the answer, I think, again, was fairly feeble. Well, the state would have legitimate policy concerns there that they don't have here. And Justice Alito immediately came back. What do you mean? What's the logic that allows you to draw that distinction? They claim to have very valid public policy arguments here. And it was almost as if the attorney arguing for the plaintiffs or petitioners really hadn't thought to come to grips with the strength of the policy arguments on the other side. When she tried to basically say there is no such thing, social science has all agreed there's no difference for children being raised in one set of circumstances or in another, Justice Kennedy then came back and said, are you basically asking us to ignore all the social science to the contrary? And more significantly, to say that the legislatures aren't allowed to consider that social science either? So it was a pretty powerful line of questions that resulted in that. She came back with, there is a social science consensus that there's going to be no harm. And both Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Scalia came back and said, that's not what the record before us shows. There is a dispute, a very significant dispute, about what the evidence, the social science evidence. And then they came back, and Chief Justice Roberts came back. Isn't the question of who gets to decide that? I thought that was a very encouraging part of the exchange. Now, when we turn to John Birch, who argued for the states on that first question, he immediately began with pointing out the big issue here is who decides. Now, here Justice Breyer seemed to be playing devil's advocate, as he often does. I think he likes the game of oral argument. He always likes confronting the lawyers at the podium with the hardest questions he can come up with for him. And it's hard to read from his intensity of questions where he comes down on a particular issue. And he was equally intense in opposition to John Birch for the states as he had been in opposition to the lawyer for the petitioners. But he said, marriage is fundamental. It's open to vast numbers of people, except one group, he says. And so we have to ask why. And, your arguments are people have always done it and religious group thinks it's a sin. Well, neither of those work for me. So what else have you got? And I think John Burson did a fabulous job tying that question back to the threat to the institution that if you remove the institution's nature as rooted in biology, as solving a particular social problem that can flow from that unique biological complementarity of men and women that doesn't exist in all these other kind of relationships we're talking about, that's the reason, and it's a compelling reason, that the states have for protecting that institution. Now, Justice Sotomayor and Ginsburg and Kagan repeatedly tried to say, I don't see how the connection exists, that if we extend marriage to new groups, that'll undermine the state's interest in responsible procreation. They didn't use that phrase, but that was what the argument that they were talking about. And John Birch did, I think, a terrific job coming back around and saying, anytime you're talking about taking an institution that has been child-centric in its nature and saying that that is no longer the purpose. And in fact, that's the only reason states got involved or the governments got involved in the marriage business in the first place. And if you take that out of the equation, yeah, it's not going to happen over, necessarily immediately, but over decades, you're going to have a profound and likely, very likely negative impact from redesigning the institution away from it, what it had always been. And he started down the road of the no-fault divorce example that we did. We changed just one of the elements of marriage, the kind of notion that it's a permanent relationship, and made it much easier and flexible to get out of any time you hit a bump in the road. And what have we seen? Well, a dramatic increase in out-of-wedlock births and broken homes and all of the consequences that have flowed from that to society and the harms to the kids. Now, Justice Kennedy, I think, came back with a very powerful counterpoint. And he said, look, your whole argument assumes that same-sex couples don't have the same noble purpose when they're raising children to substitute their interest for their children's interest. And, you know, and John responded, I think, very well, that when you're changing the definition, it has consequences. And we're not talking about just the few children that are being raised by same-sex couples, but we're talking about 73 million children. We're concerned about all of them. And when you weaken the institution of marriage, you harm a significant number of them who will no longer be raised with the benefits of the institution of marriage. Now, Justice Kagan tried to respond to that by pointing out, well, you're going to prevent those benefits of marriage from applying to same-sex couples' children. And he said, no, we're not doing that. We are channeling the institution for the place where most children are raised. I thought he did a very good and deft job in addressing and shifting the conversation to that institutional harm, rather than and didn't let anybody kind of stereotypically say, how are we going to harm your marriage if I get to get married as well? He kept coming back to this institutional point, and I thought it was a very effective. You know, I think most people came out of there back where they began, which is a lot of this is going to turn on Justice Kennedy. And the principal legal arguments are, we've never applied heightened scrutiny in the sexual orientation context. We whether our cases defining marriage as a fundamental right mean a redefined marriage to encompass same-sex relationships is also fundamental. Is something that will have to be addressed in the legal analysis that whoever writes the opinion will write. But what will drive Justice Kennedy is this kind of balance. Are we harming the institution and therefore the millions of kids that are benefited by having that strong marriage institution if we redefine it away from its core biological purpose? And if Justice Kennedy, I think, believes that, and he seemed certainly receptive to the argument, and he seems fully conversant in the briefs that have been filed on that argument, then I think he'll write the constitutional analysis that you know, a good originalist constitutional analysis would write. If he doesn't think there's any harm on the other side, and he's not persuaded that there's even any speculation of risk, then I think he'll write an opinion much like he did in Windsor that focuses more on these claims of dignitary and harms if we don't treat all relationships as if they were marriages. And so I think that's where the crux of the argument comes down. Justice Kennedy, on that precise point, of course, didn't give any strong indication one way or another, other than that discussion about millennium. You're asking us nine, us untutored in the social science nine, to weigh in on something here that has been constant across cultures, across time, for over a millennia. And one took away from those comments that he may not be prepared to do that, even if a lot of people are asking and hoping that he is. So that's the dynamic of the first question. The second question, the lawyer for petitioners, Douglas Howard Dreimer, kept wanting to re-argue the first question. And the justices kept saying, look, we've assumed for purposes of the second question that the states are allowed to keep a man-woman definition of marriage. So I don't want to hear that they have no interest in protecting that institution of marriage. I want you to focus on, assuming they get to have that definition in their law, do they have a right not to recognize marriages that don't meet that definition that are performed in other states? And he seemed to flounder on that question. Finally tried to say, if they have an interest in not issuing the marriage in first place because it's in furtherance of their public policy, it's different than saying they also have an interest in stripping away the marriage that somebody had already had. And, you know, that argument, he finally got to it toward the end of his allotted 30 minutes in time, seemed to have some traction with at least some of the justices. But the swing votes on this one, Justice Kennedy in particular, seemed fairly quiet during this portion of the argument. So it's a little hard to read at all where he's coming down. Now, before the lawyer for the state, Joseph Whalen, Justice Scalia came right out of the box and said, I'm so happy to be actually looking at some constitutional text here. And he read the full faith and credit clause to everybody. It says, you know, the states are obligated to give full faith and credit to the acts and judgments, acts, records, and judgments of the other states. Now, Justice Scalia stopped at that point. He did not go on and read the rest of the clause, which says that Congress can decide in what manner and to what effect those judgments of other states have to be given effect in the states. But the conversation then focused on a long-recognized exception to the full faith and credit clause, long recognized by the Supreme Court itself, and it's the same exception that the full faith and credit clause text actually recognizes that Congress can implement as well. To what effect other states' judgments? And the court rightly recognized that you got to give effect to another state's judgment to the extent that it bears on their policy. But if it is now going to intrude and force you to change your own policy, you don't have to give full faith and credit to that. Because if we allow that, then one state, like Massachusetts, could define the marriage policy for all 50 states and impose their policy judgment on all the rest of the states, and federalism would be gone. It would be to the most radical denominator immediately. And a number of the justices seemed to recognize that the question turned on how strong the state's public policy was. And then when they said, and we're assuming for purpose of this question, that we've already said the state policy is strong enough to support its right to retain the definition of man-woman marriage. So what is it that would say, if we've assumed that they can't protect that policy judgment from incursions by other states if we force them to recognize marriages performed in other states? And that's I think, where the question was left there. I think a number of the justices recognize that if the states are not constitutionally prohibited from keeping a man-woman definition of marriage to answer the question about whether they are obligated to recognize marriages from other states that violate that very important policy consideration would essentially be to thwart the state's policy judgment just gradually rather than all at once. And I think there were a number of justices that demonstrated they understood that problem and weren't willing to go there. Whether there's five for that proposition or not, I think, is a very open question. And you didn't get enough in the questions from the other members of the bench to be able to decide that.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.